welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer. And with me is...
You were doing a good line from the movie?
Yeah, there are a lot of good lines in this one. I didn't mark it down. This happens every time now. It's about the Giancarlo Esposito thing about the croissant scene, that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. Anyway, it's Joel. He's here, too.
Yeah, I'm sorry to disappoint everybody. I didn't write down any lines from the movie. There were a lot of things that made me laugh, though. So I'm sure your intro would have been great.
Turning for a second time is Scott Thurow of Zebras in America, and just a composer. How do you describe yourself, Scott?
I would describe myself as a song and dance man. I think that's a Bob Dylan quote. But yeah, I don't know. I do a lot of things. I'm a podcaster. I'm a musician. I collect bird calls. I make ambient music. You know. I'm a complicated guy, and I'm also not.
So, I'd like to thank you for coming back on. And you picked Mo' Better Blues.
Yeah.
So, what made you pick this movie?
Well, one, when we were discussing potential movies to talk about, and Spike Lee films that were still available. This was one I wanted to revisit. Two, I wanted to talk about some of the things outside of the world that created the world of the film. And I also thought it was a good opportunity to rewatch the movie.
Okay. This was for me a first time watch. I've been holding off on this one, because I knew it was coming up eventually. So I decided, well, I might as well save it for the episode. And I kind of wish I watched it earlier. It's not my favorite by a long shot, but still a very, very good one during the first phase of Spike's career. I think his first phase, like from She's Gonna Have It to Malcolm X, is his most consistent. Then after that, it gets real... up and down.
Sure.
Yeah, I just also, I'm always interested in people's follow-ups to their quote-unquote masterpieces, to like the pieces that they're often defined after. And it's always interesting when they try to do a less, you know, pointed piece, you know, do the right thing had all this very important and time specific content, and this movie was about a jazz man, and there's a lot about jazz and what jazz was in the 90s and the connections of, you know, the main character played by Denzel Washington. I believe that his instrumentation is performed by Branford Marsalis, who was like the Marsalises have been actively trying to reinvigorate jazz music. And in that time period, you know, Branford Marsalis had Buckshot LaFunk. And so it's a different sort of thing. And I think it's a smart way to pivot away from that. And, you know, he still was able to find controversy with this movie. People forget now that Spike Lee was a very controversial director back then. And he comes back still as doing controversial things, but it seemed like there's nothing he could do correctly in the eyes of mainstream media in the 90s. Mm. So, you know,
yeah,
his films were too ethnic.
Well, you know, speaking of which, you know, I don't know how you want to get into the film, but
mm-hmm. Well, first I wanted to know, because the first episode we did was on Charles Burnett, so we didn't have too much Spike talk, but what's your history with Spike Lee? Like, can you remember when you first even heard of him, and like the first...
Absolutely I do, because I grew up in Brooklyn, and I went to PS29 in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, and my teacher in second grade was also Spike Lee's second grade teacher. So,
whoa.
And she, you know, she was like, do you know of this director, Spike Lee? And I was like, I think so. I mean, I was 7 or 8. So I didn't watch Do the Right Thing in the theaters. I think the first Spike Lee movie I saw in theaters was Malcolm X, but I saw Mo' Better Blues on VHS, and I've always been fascinated with Spike Lee, and I realized looking at his IMDb yesterday that I've watched most of his movies. I think he has moments of true greatness. He's a really interesting, you watch the way, especially in Mo' Better Blues, the way that he's able to take his influences and then really create his own thing. You can sort of see some of the, I mean, he talks about some of his previous influences. It's not like a secret. And then you see how he incorporates that, but still there's like a lot of gorgeous crane shots in the movie Mo' Better Blues. And there's a lot of use of contrasting colors and using wide lenses for close-ups and like allowing the camera as a storytelling technique. And I really have always liked his way of using cameras as storytelling techniques, and his use of very deliberate camera motions. And I realize that my favorite movie of his is probably Bamboozled, but I don't.
Oh, you're in good company. That's also my favorite Spike.
Yeah, it's just so visceral and powerful, and I've always been interested when people like really take advantage of new media and make it work and make it work for what they're doing. So, you know, a lot of people know that Bamboozled was shot on like some very early digital tech, and it has that feeling, and it's very overwhelming. And I also worked at a record store at the time, so I was obsessed with the soundtrack before it even came out. So and me and my friends went to see it the day it came out in Cobble Hill Movie Theater on Kane Street.
I remember the day well.
Yeah, I did, because that movie's kind of fucked up, and it has a lot of content that I didn't know a lot about, and I did research, and this is when, you know, 20 years ago it was a little bit harder to find out information, which I'm grateful for, because there was a lot of painful history connected to Bamboozled, you know, minstrelry and Sambo characters and blackface and the complicated history of tap dancing in the black community. And I the movie also required that I learned a lot, and I was appreciative to have to do some work and do the work and to understand stuff. And so, you know,
so Spencer, on the opposite on opposite spectrum of good Spike Lee movies, I'm gonna try keep this quick. What's your take on like She Hate Me and stuff like that? That's like bad but kind of odd.
I like Girl 6. I think She Hate Me is fine. The one The one that came out a couple years ago, Chirac, was mm-hmm. really not great to me. I thought The Sweet Blood of Jesus is incredibly slept on. I think it's like probably my last favorite movie of his. Because I really like Ganja and Hess Bilgun, and I thought it was a very well done remake, and a lot of people hated on it, and I don't think they even saw it.
Yeah, we're big supporters of The Sweet Blood of Jesus.
Yeah, I think we talked about it on the last episode. I don't remember.
And any talk of that movie is good, so people know it's worth watching.
Yeah, because we were talking about like non-vampire movies.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is a genre I'm into. And I just saw a really, really good, mm-hmm. really interesting new zombie movie last week called Blood Quantum, which is about a zombie outbreak that happens in a Native Canadian reservation and surrounding it. And that was pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
I'm trying to think. I thought Summer of Sam was really, really didn't get a fair shake. I really liked that movie.
Hmm.
That's one of his that gets a bad rap, I think.
It's interesting how wide a take it is on like the many people we've had on here talking about like what they like, what they don't like, and it's like, you know, previously we had done the one on Kurosawa, and most, if not all of his movies are pretty much masterpieces, so you don't really get people being like, oh, this is good, and then you talk to somebody the next time, it's like, oh, that's bad, you know? But with Spike Lee stuff, like, I bet we could find at least somebody who likes, you know, something that's usually discarded along with the things that people just forget that he made, you know. The one we're always ragging on is She Hate Me, so this is the first time I've heard somebody being like, yeah, I mean, it's fine.
Yeah, I don't know. It's,
and that's, it's... I like that take. Like, I wouldn't tell somebody to change their mind about a Spike Lee movie.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly doesn't age well. It's definitely problematic. It's also fine. I remember watching it and I'm like, this is one of those things where it's not as bad as people are saying it is, but it's not great.
We'll be forever grateful to it for giving us the CGI sperm with Anthony Mackie's face on it.
Ah, yes, that's what cinema was gearing up towards since the late 1800s. It was leading up to that moment.
Yep.
And just before, I just wanted to say... We recently interviewed a gentleman, John Carluccio, who's doing a film about Maurice Hines, and he put me on to this great tap dancing podcast called The Tap Love Tour, and they have an episode 87 is about Bamboozled, and has like, it has like talks about it from a tap dancing perspective, and black tap dancers as well, and I thoroughly recommend that. Though we're talking about Mo Better Blues, Spike yeah. Lee's 1990 follow-up to Do the Right Thing.
Yeah. And like for... Because like, Joel, I think you can follow me on this. Like, compared to like the other follow-ups to like the big hit, not like masterpieces, like with Kurosawa, his follow-ups were always stuff like The Idiot after Rashomon, which is like, is good, but at the same time it's like, this is a weird follow-up to do, and like we just talked about Kirkland, which was kind of a weird follow-up to Malcolm X, and for this is like a follow-up to like the big cultural hit that's actually pretty good.
Hmm. It seems like his, I mean, when he gets a hit, he wants to try to do something more personal, because I mean, Crooklyn is based around his life growing up, right? And this I can't help but feel like, you know, touches of his father. I mean, his father's literally in it, and his sister, and like the pressure of being, you know, expectations like, what do you make of your life if your family's been grooming you to... I don't even know. What were they grooming him to be? A famous trumpet player?
Just to be like a musician. Like, for 10 years, I played cello. And I was in, like, various youth orchestras. And there was one kid who was in multiple youth orchestras that I was in who was kind of like Bleak in the movie. Like, from a young age, like, he was basically, like, trained to, like, what you're going to do is music, and you're going to focus on music, and that'll be your whole life. And, like, and he didn't turn out like Bleak. He turned out a little... I mean, he's always kind of quiet and awkward, but, like, he kind of, you know, like, was just, like this guy was kind of like a, almost like a musical prodigy, or, like, pretty fucking close. He was, like, kind of incredible at violin, like from, like, age seven. But, you know, like, but, like, so, like, I kind of am familiar with this type of person, except, like, this is, at least up until the end, Mulberry Blues is, like, the success version of, like, oh, this is what happens, like, when it does go right.
Right.
Until it doesn't go right.
Right. And like, so like Mo Better Blues starts with a flashback to this young kid who can't go out and play with his friends because he has to practice playing the trumpet. And then he grows up to be this very talented trumpeter played by Denzel Washington. And he's got this great band with, you know, Spike Lee regulars, you know, Giancarlo Esposito, and you have, Wesley Snipes as the saxophone guy, Shadow, who's really quite good in this movie. And, you know, rest in peace, William Goldwyn Nunn, the third. And you have Spike Lee as the troubled manager, and then the Turturro brothers, playing these characters that I'm going to talk about a little bit, which was one of the reasons I also wanted to get on the show. And you know,
I was curious about your take on with those two brothers. I hear like a lot of people have opinions about like Nick and John Turturro in this movie.
Yeah. Unless, and then you have
what do you mean? You guys don't like Italians?
I don't think they were Italian in this movie.
What?
They play Jewish characters there. I don't know.
I think, you know, I've seen this movie twice now. I think I know what's going on here. No. Yes, they are. I was playing coy this time.
But I just really like that the movie, you know, you're like going through the mind of this dude who just like can't really think about anything other than the music, and he can't really understand how much he's hurting the two women in his life and alienating everyone around him. But then, you know, when you focus in on him making the music, you have these remake, there's this monochrome sort of Roy DeCavera, who did like the iconic John Coltrane album covers that are in the movie. There are these moments where you have the coloration and the monochrome that feels like it's a jazz cover, and you feel in the jazz. It does a really good job of when the jazz music is happening to feel the energy of it with, and you have so many different motifs of photography in the movie, because you have the interiors of like, you sort of realize that Denzel Washington's character doesn't make eye contact with anyone about 20 minutes before the women in his life point that out. And so, yeah, as I said earlier, his use of camera angles and cinematography to establish a mood tells this really, really helps move along this story of what seems to be everything's going good, but then, you know, his manager's kind of has a really bad gambling habit that kind of kind of messes up things.
And a few cast members that should be mentioned. Abby Lincoln is the mom in the flashback, and she is the, I think they get the wife, forgot her name, and Nothing But a Man. And Robin Harris is a stand-up in between their in between their jazz sets.
Yeah,
this was his final movie, or it has been his final movie.
It was his final movie
because he did the first House Party, and I don't think House Party 2 was after this. I'm pretty sure.
No, and House Party is another, you know, 1990 movie.
Yeah, and also rest in peace Charlie Murphy. I was surprised to see him, and I wanted more of him. I wish he was like a bigger character in this.
What I really liked about, so Charlie Murphy plays like a doorman in the movie, and his coworker doorman in like 30 seconds explains the 5% nation and the gods of earth, and like explains divine mathematics really well. And I was like, whoa, I did not remember this part. So I just thought, I thought the ability to pack in so much cultural significance without beating you over the head or beating you in the face with the trumpet foreshadowing, was really cool.
Yeah. Like this, I think of all Spike movies to cover, this might be the lead, like him as most reserved. Because even though it does have like the overbearing, like Spike, with the stuff he's passionate about, he's not subtle at all. But like this is for him a pretty subtle movie compared to a lot of his movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's subtle for him. I wouldn't call it a subtle movie.
Yeah, well, I should clarify. Yeah, a subtle for Spike, not for other people.
Because there's a shit ton of crane shots for a subtle movie.
Yeah.
I can't compliment the cinematography and the photography and that enough.
Yeah, and this is when Ernest Dickerson was still doing cinematography.
Yeah,
this was third to last. Because it was Jungle Fever and then Malcolm X, and then after that, Ernest Dickerson went on to do, I think, Surviving in Game, might have been his first feature he did, or he might have done something right before that.
I mean, my favorite of his is the criminally slept on Never Die Alone, but that's just me.
I haven't seen that, but I generally do like stuff that Ernest directs.
It's really good. It did not get a chance. It did not get a shot. I think Donald Goins is one of the great writers of not our time, because I'm 37, but you know, he is a great writer that didn't get enough love. He did not get the flowers he deserved while he could smell them. And Never Die Alone is a particularly strange novel, and they took some liberties in the movie, but it's good. It really is.
Yeah. And before we started recording, I mentioned my brain's fried. We mentioned She Hate Me, and there's some parallels to She Hate Me, because you have like the dealing with women and their romance and with multiple women, and there's a very jazzy score, and She Hate Me might have one of Spike's jazziest scores, and also that's my personal favorite score of any Spike movie. There's a scene of the lead character with his best friend / confidant, and they're riding bikes and talking about like women, and there's like graphic sex, just like in She Hate Me. And it feels like She Hate Me kind of borrowed some, like, a few things, like, from this, but, like, kind of added on, like, 50 other things to talk about, too.
Mm. I mean, well, I mean, yeah, which, hold on, what was I going to say? I was going to say She Hate Me has those other things going for
yeah.
What I was actually going to say was that, did either of you think of that scene from, I think it's the first Muppet movie with the riding the bikes, or is that the second Muppet movie when Spike and Denzel were riding bikes together?
I mean,
Spike kind of looks like a little Muppet.
I didn't, but Muppets Take Manhattan is a great New York film.
I'd rather they take Manhattan than Jason.
Oh definitely.
Jason's there for like 15 minutes. Just a
Jason is strictly Canadian.
Well, there's that really like epic boxing scene on a roof in Jason Takes Manhattan. But don't talk. I'm gonna get nightmares, dude. I don't like talking about scary stuff, man. I'd rather talk about existential dilemmas like that of a Jasmine in the 90s and breaking people's hearts and not really taking emotional inventory because you've been so focused on one thing. Mm-hmm. And I think the first scene is so strong because I remember sometimes when I would be back when I was a younger guy and I'd be drinking at bars, and me and my friends were so annoyed with Tom Waits, you know, the musician Tom Waits.
Mm-hmm.
Cause
I know him more for acting, but yeah,
sure. I mean, he has a legendary acting career and has some truly great performances, Down by Law being just one of many great ones. But he had this sort of, he's had this persona of this, you know, drunkard hobo sort of cool guy dude. And I was like, he was like classically trained pianist or something like that. And I was like, you're not that good at piano and also like jumping on trains, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You to be there, even if you're naturally gifted, you still have to practice your instrument. You have to practice. You have to do that. You know, when Jay-Z was dissing Nas by saying, you know, you saw stuff out of your window and drew it in your notepad and created your life, I was like, that is a really hard diss, because I feel like that you have to sort of stay at home to really get that good at your art or to get that proficient. So it sucks to not be able to go out and play ball, but I get it, to be that good.
Yeah.
And like in the movie, Bleak is really so good. And even though he's starting to get, you know, overshadowed by Shadow, who has his own aspirations, everyone acknowledges how good he is, and he's coming up with ideas, this is a good one. This is a pretty good movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And around the time this comes out, we'll have dropped the Wesley Snipes episode, and watching this is like, this is a yet another reminder of Snipes is pretty fucking great. In like I just love his presence here. And like every time I see a different Snipes movie, like I always see a different side of him as a performer. And here's just like, oh, he's like the turncoat, but he's also kind of, you know, like empathetic and sympathetic, because like he's, you know,
he's a noisy kisser. That's what I noticed from this watch.
Yeah, that's true. And he, one thing that kind of annoyed me about the movie, which is like super petty, because I really do think that verisimilitude is overrated in movies, is they try to pretend like there's a Tower Records in Brooklyn, you know? And that really bothered me because Tower Records was a really important cultural institution for me and so many people, and it was in many classic movies, and it was in the East Village, and there was also one uptown, and also in many other places, but there wasn't a Tower Records in Brooklyn. So when Shadow, Wesley Snipes' character, is trying to woo one of Bleak's partners. Bleak has two girlfriends, and one of them is a musician, but Bleak doesn't see that because he doesn't really see past himself. And Wesley Snipes' character goes to Tower Records and to really just talk to her, and they create their own musical act and stuff. But he does have so many talents, Wesley Snipes, as an actor. I recently rewatched Disappearing Acts. Did y'all talk about that one?
No. We kind of focused on it as action movies and like Tuong Fu, and that's.
Oh, really, okay. Well,
yeah, I don't think I've heard of that one.
Disappearing Acts is, I think it came out like probably 2000, 2001, 2002, maybe. It was a made for HBO movie, as based off of a Terry McMillan book, and it's just about a relationship, and it's really just about a relationship, and it works.
That's cool. Okay. I like his drama roles over his action roles personally. Not to say that he's not an amazing action performer, but I don't know, there's something just truly special about him doing drama.
Yeah, I mean, Demolition Man is great, you know, who doesn't use three shells to wipe their tuchus, but, you know.
Yeah, one of my favorite dramas.
Yeah.
He's more than that, and like this, and like him with Spike Lee, like Spike brings out, I think Spike is able to control Snipes better than other directors, even in like Chirac, which his character, I'm not too big on that movie that much. I like some parts, but overall not really. But Snipes is it my
best. I like it.
Yes, I know. I'm not trying to throw shade at you. That wasn't a pun. That's, but like Snipes in that movie, he could have been too over the top and too, because like he does that weird little giggle throughout. But like it's just enough, and like it just stays. I don't know. I lost my train of thought.
But there's also I also like how both Denzel Washington and Wesley Snipes had their own sort of like futuristic movies, except Denzel Washington was the good guy in Virtuosity with Russell Crowe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought you were talking about Training Day. That's the future, right?
I mean, the future, if you're talking about Mo Better Blues, yes.
And compared to this movie, it is.
Oh shit! I forgot about Inside Man. That's one of my top three Spike Lee. I like caper movies with a twist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, I just rewatched that one recently, and man, is good.
It's excellent.
Yeah, the last one he did with done with Denzel. I hope Denzel comes back to Spike. That's my favorite Denzel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tony Scott Denzel's fun and everything, but like Spike just brings out something in Denzel.
Deja Vu is a fun movie.
It is.
Didn't you just say that? Okay, sorry, that was an obligatory joke.
Yeah, I understood what you were doing. I mean, I could see. I don't know how far they got into Prince of Cats before the COVID pandemic put a halt on things. And I'm hoping to have the comic book writer of Prince of Cats on my show again, Ronald Wimberly. He was on our show before, So I'll probably ask him what's going on there. But I could see Denzel being in that movie and making it work, even though the main character is being played by Lakeith Stanfield. Mm-hmm. And that's the Prince of Cats is sort of, you know, a side story of Romeo and Juliet told from the point of view of Mercutio, right? Mm-hmm. Right, that's who the Prince of Cats is.
Joel, you know Shakespeare better than me.
No, I don't. Yeah, but I have no idea.
No, it's Tybalt. It's Tybalt, I think. Okay. But what, you know, Shakespeare is dope, but it's Tybalt, and it's set in like a 1980s New York style, but it's still using pentameter and all that. And for some reason, I always get Mercutio and Tybalt mixed up, but. Last I checked, that was going to be Spike Lee's next movie.
Yeah, and the Vietnam one comes out in a few weeks. Actually, Dark Time just comes out. It might be out by then.
I'm scared of that one.
I'm worried it might be shitty.
Yes, it could. That's what I'm saying. I'm scared.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm hopeful. I like the cast. This just doesn't
so.
Anyway,
this guy, Bleak here.
Yeah.
Something puzzles me about his character. Like, we know he's kind of like uneasy. Like, he's really focused on himself. But do you guys think he has like a plan? Does he have a goal? Because he seems to be like, I've got my own band. We're performing. We're getting paid. Like, the only reason he even brings up money is because the other band members are asking him to get paid more. It's like, is he satisfied with most of his life? Like, he's got two lovely ladies that he's seen, and like I said, he's playing the trumpet.
I mean, he just seems stagnant. Like, if he's playing music, you know, presumably every night, or like many nights a week or whatever, but like, he just seems just content and he doesn't want to change the situation. Like he seems like this. It's brought up in the movie, like, times are changing, he has to evolve and you know, change his music and to, but you know, he's just, I don't think there's any plan of him like beyond just playing music. Just as long as he gets to play music, it's all that matters.
I think he's writing, you know, you sort of see him coming up with ideas, and he creates a bunch of pieces during the film, and he's got some sort of rappy songs that he's working on, and as I said earlier, the Branford Marsalis Quartet is his band, with the music, I think, being written by Terrence Blanchard, I believe. Yes. And so he's making music as it's going on. I think but I also think he's just like, I don't care. I'm just going to do this and live my life. And just, it doesn't matter until the gambling addiction of giant Spike Lee's character just makes everything terrible.
Kind of suddenly crumble, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, but I mean, that's also how, when he...
Sorry, that's how crippling addiction kind of works. It can start real small, and then all of a sudden it comes thundering down. I think they handled the gambling addiction quite well.
Yeah. I mean, he also starts... It seems like he's getting little cracks in his whatever is going on when both of the women leave him, you know, and he's, at some point he finally starts to feel lonely. He's making phone calls and stuff like that. And he still can't be like, I need you or anything. He's trying to play it cool because that's the only way he knows how to play it. And that's it's to his detriment. But like, I wonder what would have happened to him if the whole gambling thing hadn't come to a head, like, would he have imploded on himself? You know, the band would have broken up because he couldn't take whatever pressure he was creating in his own self or something like that?
I think either way, Shadow would have left. Because yeah. Like the first moment you see it on stage, Shadow they use, like, basketball metaphors. Like, he's basically like Carmelo Anthony, like, five seasons ago. Like, you know, just trying to hit threes all by himself. And, like, that would have imploded. That would have imploded the situation either way.
Yeah, or if you think of, you know, Miles Davis's first great quintet, you know. John Coltrane played on there, but there was... and he's good, but you heard the potential that he had to go on his own, you know? Yeah. And I think they were trying to create that sort of idea. I don't think the world exists to have even if there are people as talented and bright as Miles Davis and John Coltrane in this world, I don't think we have the capacity to have jazz music like that anymore, because even the jazz music that's being made is very different right now. You know.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like, slightly off topic, there's a free jazz concert every year in Wilmington, Delaware. The Clifford Brown, the Jazz Festival, and he's a jazz musician from, I think, the 60s. 50s, I can't remember when exactly, but he, like, was from Wilmington, and he died very young. I think it was, like, a car crash. He's, like, driving to Philly or New York for a show, but the jazz performers that are there every year, it's always very varied and different. Like, like you're saying, like, the jazz now is just very, it's a totally, almost like, in some ways, a totally different world.
Yeah, I mean, it's got its own world. It exists on grants. It exists on festivals. It's similar to classical. It has its vibes. And, you know, one of my biggest issues with the movie Whiplash, you remember that movie that came out a few years ago?
I can't watch that because it reminds me of a youth orchestra leader I had that I didn't get along with.
Yeah, I remember that.
I always joke that movie was like a sci-fi movie, because it was kind of pretending like being in a jazz band was something in 2014 that it's not, you know. Uh-huh. I was like this is not a real reality. I mean, it's real reality for them, but I don't know. I also just I didn't. That movie, I don't like that sort of, you know, I'm going to be terrible to you because you have potential thing. That doesn't work for me. That sort of pedagogy, I don't think is effective or sustainable.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about the person. Let's move on. I want to bring him up.
Excellent.
Yeah. I stopped playing cello for a lot of reasons, and that kind of led to me not wanting to play cello anymore. But
I hear you. And then, you know, so then towards the end of the movie, as we were saying, you know, Giant is getting further and further in debt. He gets fired by the band, and he's in hiding. He's getting his shit beat up, blah, blah, blah. And Shadow starts dating one of Bleak's exes, and they start making their own music together and shit, and it all comes to a head. And then, you know, there's this really visceral, painful scene where, you know, Bleak gets knocked in the face with his own trumpet by a loan shark.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's so painful, and you understand what's happening right there, man. You know, like, oh, this is it. And you see how these little things can change people's lives, because because he gets knocked up in the face, which permanently messes up his ability to play the horn. And it reminds me of athletes or people that could have been, and all it takes is one bad break, one little thing that can change your course of life. Or you guys ever listen to that David Bowie album, Ziggy Stardust?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's actually a lot of comparisons between this album, that album, and this movie, because, you know, they to get back at him, they break his hands, Ziggy Stardust, so he can't play the guitar anymore. Mm-hmm. And he's like the greatest guitar player. Mm-hmm. And I can't not connect the two.
It could be a connection.
Ways, him not being able to play the horn anymore sort of allows him to live his life in a way, almost.
Yeah. Without that thing being the one thing he can always count on, you know, he has to really change the way he does things. And he has to, like, he takes like a year sabbatical to even figure out like what he wants to do, what he can do.
Yeah.
I have a problem with the scene where he does like try to, you know, do one show with Shadow's band, because he wouldn't have just gone up there and just tried to play the trumpet. Like, he would have been practicing. Like, that's the one thing that we know about Bleak, is that he was, you know, practicing all the time, constantly worried about his lips. It wouldn't have been just like, you know, a one-off thing. I'm just going to step up there and play the trumpet. I'm sure he would have been worried about that. So when, in the middle of the performance, when I play the trumpet, so when his lips are basically getting tired, it seems like, and they, you know, a year off, of course, he wouldn't be able to do that. Plus, whatever damage, you know, we're presuming he hasn't touched it and he hasn't adjusted to whatever shape his lips are now. It makes sense that he would lose it in the middle of the performance there, but I don't think it makes sense for his character to have done something like that.
Yeah. That was a weird one.
Yeah. I mean, it's a Spike Lee movie, so like I feel like there was like probably like a 3-hour cut of this, and like there's probably some stuff with the 1 year off that was cut out for time, because like once that part hits, when like he's taking a break, it feels rushed. Like, it doesn't, like the rest movie, the first few parts, the first two thirds or whatever, are very, not slow, but like they're paced moderately, and like it's easy to follow, but then suddenly it just like goes into double speed towards the end, and it's like, wait, this feels like there's something in between. It just maybe like messed up the flow of the movie, or like there's this too many side stories or something. Because it's like, for Spike Lee movie, there's not that many subplots to deal with. Usually it's a few too many subplots, but this one is pretty focused.
Yep, one of the reasons why it's good. I think that the rushing at the end actually kind of makes sense for me, because like the beginning part where he's focused on the trumpet, he's focused on himself, like once he starts getting into these more real moments with like a woman he actually loves, you know, they're gonna have a child together, they get married, like all this stuff happens, and then like we jump pretty far for, you know, watching the baby crawl and things like that. Like, I feel like the passage of time would feel that going that fast. Like, what was I doing the other day? I don't know, but I remember my baby crawling. Okay. Like, or something like that. And then all of a sudden, you know, he's playing the trumpet, and I'm watching him, and was I really ever that guy before? I guess yes. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I sort of liked the coda. I liked how dreamy and forward how forward moving it was, and you know, him figuring out the woman that he cares about and them starting a life, and then the circularity, the last scene sort of mirroring the first scene. The first scene is he is a kid, he can't go out and play because he has to practice, and then he, in the end, he has a 10-year-old kid who wants to go out and play, and he's like, go and play. I liked it. I thought the ending was fine, you know?
Well, like, the last moment, I liked this, like, getting to it just felt rushed. But it should be noted that the baby, it's a live birth on camera, and it's Wesley Snipes' son.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's in the credits.
I didn't look that far.
Is that the record for the youngest actor in a movie? Like, I know there's been films of people giving birth before, but in major motion pictures.
I guess. And I guess this is the first instance of son and father being in the same movie for Spike. Because then in Malcolm X, you get a little John David Washington. As one of the little kids in the Harlem school.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there were a whole bunch of them then, because there not only is there... wait, who were we talking about? Whose baby that was?
That's Snipes' baby.
Wesley Snipes' baby, yeah. So Wesley Snipes and his kid, and then Bill Lee, right? That's his father's name?
Yeah.
Bill. And Spike there. And... Denzel probably smuggled his kid in. You didn't get credited, but.
And then you have the brothers Turturro playing club owners.
So can we talk about that? Because I want to know what's going on here.
Yeah. So yeah. when the movie came out, Spike Lee was criticized for these characters by the Anti-Defamation League, which is a group that makes sure that Jewish characters are not portrayed in a certain way. And they do, you know, they do a lot of other things. And I never did I think watching the movie was I like, I'm offended by these characters. I'm Jewish, by the way. And I wasn't like, this is offensive. I wasn't. Sometimes there are characters that fit archetypes, and those they're to me, I was like, oh yeah, I've met club owners like that. That's all I thought. And I thought, you know, also Spike Lee never really responds to criticism. He's pretty unapologetic, and his response I thought was spot on. You know, this, you know, about double standards of characters, that sometimes there's characters. And as I was saying earlier, there's just such a fine tooth comb on Spike Lee for anything he did. You know, he couldn't win. So I think he's just, you know, even when he finally started doing movies about white protagonists, he wasn't doing it right. It took him a long time for people to even accept him, and even if he is accepted, and even when he did the video for the Michael Jackson song, They Don't Really Care About Us, right?
He might have. He's done a lot of music videos and comedy specials. And
stuff like that song was particularly controversial. Again, not to me, because Michael Jackson in the original song says, "Kick me, kike me, don't you black or white me," which people thought was anti-Semitic. Again, I did not think it was anti-Semitic. I think it was a play on language and talking about the frivolity of hate. and Spike Lee directed that video. I'm pretty sure. I should probably look that up so people who are listening are like, Scott's wrong. He, you know, but yeah, I think.
Yeah. In a similar thing. The way he's filmed Robin Harris' stand-up, it really feels like if Robin Harris will live longer, there's going to be a stand-up special that Spike was going to do with him. Because parts of it just felt like, I'm just going to let Robin just go for a little bit. And like it felt kind of like just watching like just like a stand-up on TV, which I did like this. Like it adds some nice variety. And Robin Harris is also really funny. I mean, which
Spike Lee did. Spike Lee did direct the video for "They Don't Really Care About Us," by the way. But yeah, I don't know. I think just because ethnic characters are represented doesn't necessarily mean it's offensive. And I didn't find these characters to be offensive. I was not offended. It was when I was doing research for this episode and I saw that people were upset. And I was like, huh.
Yeah. It's definitely not the worst, characterization Spike has done. Like, his character, to Spike at this point, it's kind of like, yeah, it definitely could have been much worse. Like, we have seen it handled him handling this stuff in this territory in a much worse way, and this is just, like...
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't know. It didn't offend me. And I don't think that he was trying to poke fun at Jewish people. And, I think if you go 14, 15 years ahead and you see Inside Man, you see that he's just telling stories. And I thought his in that movie, which has a Jewish sub-story, I thought the characters were represented very carefully and thoughtfully.
You were talking about the color palette earlier, and it's like, there was this at the club where they performed. There's a lot of like bathing the hallways in red.
There's a lot of red.
This is so evocative and just like not so like beautiful, but like it's just so striking. Just like how much red, when red would show up, just how like. How powerful it looked on screen, which I don't know how to explain beyond it's just such a powerful image of Spike just used red in such a striking way in this.
There's a lot of red in the movie. There's a lot of purple. There's a lot of blue. There's a lot of interesting camera tricks, and I recommend everyone should check it out.
Oh, Spike Lee cam. It happened, I think, three or four times, which I think is the most so far we've seen.
I can only think of the one time where I was going to call him Mookie. Giant is about to get caught going back to his place.
It happens there, and it happens at the beginning when Denzel is having sex, and it happens a couple scenes before that when he is writing music. He's walking around the apartment.
Yeah, I've just turned it off. I don't even notice anymore.
I'm all on the lookout. I always like seeing it.
It's a director trademark. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. And again, not my favorite use of it. My favorite use of the Spike Lee cam is Crooklyn. I think that's by far the most fun use of it.
Oh, yeah, it's Crooklyn with the little girl, right?
Yeah.
I agree. I totally agree with that.
And when they're, the Spike character is sniffing glue, they're upside down. That's another great use for it. In Summer, Sam has, the Linguazamo getting high and him floating around. But so I don't know. I don't have much else to say about this movie besides I really did enjoy it. I wish I would have seen it earlier. I don't know if this is like a popular one because I don't really see people talk about this much online or hear see my podcast on it. Usually, if it's Spike Lee, it's just like Do the Right Thing, Inside Man. You know, like the big ones you expect. And this one, I think it's kind
Malcolm
of overlooked.
X, yeah.
Malcolm X. This one gets overlooked because it's kind of it's stuck in between the two huge ones.
Right, I think that's the problem. I think because it follows Do the Right Thing, that people will just skip over it. Like it's the same phenomenon that like I would more associate with a bad sequel followed by a mediocre sequel, and you're like, oh man, that was actually pretty good. Like a lot of people like Jurassic Park 3 because they think Lost World was terrible. Mm-hmm. And I hate to break it to you people, but Jurassic Park 3 is very mediocre. And I feel like this one is like, it can't compare to Do the Right Thing, so just don't bother. But it's a very, it's a like, it's movie. A funny movie. It's pretty good. Pretty damn good.
Yeah. And it's different.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, there's in like jazz academic writing, it's written about a lot, and there's actually quite a few academic articles about the phallus as represented in the jazz trumpet in the film Mo Better Blues, if y'all are trying to get your nerd glasses on and read about, you know, academic explanations of instruments and phalluses.
I mean, also, like, you see Trump, if it's like a TV show or movie about a jazz musician, usually it's saxophone or trumpet, because, like, those have the most, closest to, like, the human voice, so it's almost like it's singing. Because, like, you don't see, like, with drums or, like, cello or that much. It's usually trumpet and saxophone for you know.
Another reason why Whiplash was bullshit.
I'll take your word for it. It's been a while, but still a little, like, I don't want to revisit that part of my life.
No, that. I mean, I'm telling you that if you would be activated by it, I don't think it's that good of a movie, so why put yourself through it? But also, y'all ever seen Let's Get Lost about Chet Baker? Dude, man, you got to see that movie. Bruce Weber, it's so good. Speaking of how it when, you know, it's often about trumpeters or saxophone players, you know, that is a movie.
Yeah. Oh, also obligatory because it's a movie about jazz. My grandfather played piano for various jazz musicians in the 30s and 40s, including Billie Holiday, the Count Basie Orchestra on a couple occasions. But he didn't tour. He just kind of stayed in the city because he... I really don't know much about my great-grandfather. But besides, like, he was, like, kind of, like, a fill-in slash session, like, pianist for, like, the jazz scene. And he
like
might have...
somebody he could count on when they came into the area that he could just jump like, into the group.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, if they needed someone... you know, short notes, they'd call up Gilbert and he would perform. And his brother Charlie played trombone for Duke Ellington, and there's a I think it might still be up, but there's a Wikipedia on Charlie Irvis, and I kind of like Charlie Irvis a little bit, but not too much. And my great-grandfather Gilbert might have known Malcolm X when he was Malcolm Little, because Malcolm hung out with the jazz musicians in the mid-40s in New York, and he was friends with a lot of them, so I think there's potentially they might have run into each other.
That's awesome.
He was actually about to visit when on that scene where Malcolm gets arrested. He has to clear the whatever that the lye out of his hair with the toilet water.
Yeah. I'm not going to go this far. I'll say it when we're done recording what I think may have happened between them. is there any connection between this and Wild at Heart besides so there's like love and like women, I guess.
But then, oh, right, because y'all connect the Spike Lee movies to the Cannes films of that year, right?
Yeah, or Best Picture winner.
So
just like a comparison thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Talking about sometimes. Wild at Heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The David Lynch film.
I mean, they're both music oriented film. Like the Wild at Heart feels it's got plenty of songs going on in it. Like you said, love. It's like a polar opposite kind of thing where Denzel is just emotionally unavailable, where right. Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern are represented as soulmates in this. It's this other version of like a fantasy love as opposed to maybe like this bleak representation of modern love.
Yeah.
And then also like they both have endings with children. I always thought it was weird how much the movie Con Air with Nicolas Cage sort of had a similar arc to Wild at Heart, but
even got like a dolly for him, doesn't he?
Yep. Yeah, the ending scene of Con Air and Wild at Heart are pretty much the same, and that's funny to me.
I never even thought about that until he just brought that up.
I thought about it when we saw the movie.
you're welcome.
I haven't seen Con Air since I was like 15, and my dad was watching it on USA or one of those dad channels. And he like come watch us, and they're like okay, and we had a fun time watching Con Air.
That's another music movie. How do I live without you?
Anyway, so other 1990 movies, Scott. What are your picks?
Predator 2, Grifters, King of New York, Miller's Crossing, Trust, and House Party.
Only one I haven't heard of is Trust.
Trust is Hal Hartley's first movie. It's one of my favorite movies of all time, and that's all I'm going to say.
Predator 2 is amazing. I love it more than the first Predator.
Oh, but, hell yeah. Word up to Martin Kessler. Boop, 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 boop.
Never would have watched it if I wasn't friends with Kessler, and he was so passionate about it. And it's like, fine, I'll watch it, Kessler. And then it's like, oh, he's kind of right about this one. It is pretty damn good. But I know, Joel, we did ours on the episode with Amanda, but I want to again mention Talai, the Cannes Grand Prix winner, the movie from Burkina Faso. By director Idrissa Arangaro, something like that. I need to hear it said a lot first, but more people should see it. It's great, and he's a filmmaker up there with like Mbeki and Simbin, like of that. And he kind of is from like roughly the same time, but everyone should see Talai. It's great. It's about 80 minutes long. And it's
how do you spell that?
Talai is T-I-L-A-I. It or it's called The Law, which is what it means. And I don't think it's in Bambara. I think it's another language. But I can't remember what the language is.
Yeah, and I would just like to quickly re-mention Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe, which. If you've already listened to the other episode, I was saying was one of the best movies. I'm just kidding. That's You should watch Abraxas, though, because it's really stupid and funny. Okay. Not on purpose.
No, not on purpose at all. Mm-hmm. And has, like, a strange cameo from Jim Belushi as the principal from that movie where he plays the principal. I don't know if you remember that.
The movie The Principal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talai is in Mossy.
I'm just saying, James Belushi plays a principal in a movie, The Principal, and he also has a cameo as the principal in Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe.
Right, the same character from the principal, Principal Latimer, whatever.
That's such a weird connection. But
we didn't talk about the Spike Lee universe, by the way.
Oh yeah, yeah. Joel, tell the world your discovery.
Well, according to the IMDb trivia, the voice on the radio when Giant gets grabbed and they're like, "We're doing a throwback song," you know, and they play "Rescue Me," is Samuel Jackson's character from "Do the Right Thing." And since this movie came directly after "Do the Right Thing," that makes sense. But that just fits into the expanding Spike Lee-iverse. You know, that means that this movie also takes place in the Red Hook Summer area, which also is connected to She Hate Me, which is also connected to, I can't remember where all the strings go anymore.
Which means vampires exist in this universe.
Oh, yeah. And then Sweet Blood of Jesus.
Yeah, this Spike Lee connection is crazy. But Talai is in Mossy, not Bambara, like I thought. But, I want to say, because we're recording this today, Fred Willard passed away today, and he was a comedy legend, hilarious, and most recent thing I've seen him in was in I Think You Should Leave, where he plays an organ player at a funeral. But he has, like, a circus organ. It's very stupid, but, like, even, like, as of, you know, up to an end, he was still hilarious. He still had it.
Lynn Shelton also died today.
Yeah.
Which is pretty sad.
Rest in peace.
Anyway.
Yeah. But next up was Wild Art with Amanda W. Mass Liberty.
Oh, and that's going to be great. She's the best.
Yeah, so I believe you have a podcast, and I think Amanda appeared on your show talking about, like, clam pizza or something.
Amongst other things, but yeah, we talked about clam pizza a bit, and then when I was trying to figure out on my last birthday which clam pizza I wanted to eat, because I was in Connecticut, and that's a thing in whatever town Yale is at. For some reason, I'm blanking on New Haven. New Haven has pizza there, and they're known for clam pizza. And she recommended, and I got some clam pizza, and it was excellent. And we also, our podcast, we go wherever we want to go. I don't like rules. Don't tell me what to do, Spencer.
Okay, then don't plug your podcast. It's fine.
No, did I not plug? I thought I plugged it already. Zebras in America. Please check us out.
Okay. And you might be back for a secret podcast thing that Joel created. That by the time this is out, it should be first episode should be out by now, right?
I don't know. I'm working on it. Okay, let's. Okay. I said in a couple other episodes, but now I feel nervous.
Oh well, this is set for early-ish June.
Too much pressure.
Yeah, you.
That's like this, tomorrow.
Do this whenever you feel like it, man. It's gonna be okay.
Okay.
And if you guys want me on there, I'd love to. I'd love to come back on again and talk movies, because that's something I enjoy doing, and it's nice to do things you like to do.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's it. Stay safe, be smart, and,
do the right thing.
Oh.
Stop.
And mo better blue. Wait. Now I'm stopping.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.